You're listening to Trek FM.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
There was a little bar in Mill Valley where all the Starfleet trainees used to go.
The 602 Club.
You know it.
I was there more times than I can remember.
You made a mistake, my friend. No astronaut would enter the capsule carrying his air conditioner. Remove his helmet. James Bond, allow me to introduce myself. I am Ernst Stavro Blofeld. They told me you were assassinated in Hong Kong.
Yes, this is my second life.
You only live twice, Mr. Bond.
Welcome, everyone, to the 602 Club, Trek FM's General Geek Show. I'm so excited to be here. Ruby up serving up a nice sake at just the right temperature this evening, which is just fantastic. We're coming to you live from, well, a very nice bar in Japan, all to celebrate what we're going to be talking about tonight. You Only Live Twice, which one of the very few James Bond movies to only take place in pretty much one location. And I have with me the man, the myth, the legend himself, John Champion.
Matthew, thank you for that. Twice is the only way to live.
That is true. I mean, if you're going to live, twice is not bad.
And I'm so glad that Ruby is not as pedantic as James Bond to not insist on serving me sake at 98.4 degrees.
Yeah. She's not as much a stickler for the rules. She's mm-hmm. more about making sure that the customer is happy.
Mm-hmm. I could get it cold if I wanted to. And some days when it's hot out, I want cold sake.
I understand. I'm sure that our good friend Chris Jones would agree with you. Living in Japan, I know there are plenty of days where it's warm over there, and I'm pretty sure it's a nice cold beer would actually be better than a warm
right.
sake.
Indeed.
So,
indeed.
Oh gosh, well I'm so excited to be here to talk about another James Bond film with you. We have this one and one more for everybody this year, and then we'll continue on next year. But before we dive in, of course, just remind everybody you can find the 602 Club and all the Trek FM shows at iTunes.com/TrekFM. We're a featured provider over there. While you're there, hit us up with a star rating and review. It really does help with the show. Really appreciate all the people who've done that so far. It means a lot to us. And gosh, we just had the second year anniversary of the 602 Club. So thank you so much, listeners, because without you, this show would not have been the success that it's been. And you make it worth it every single week. So I just want to say a special thank you to all of you who listen each and every week. It means a lot to me. You can find us on Twitter at Trek FM, Facebook, facebook.com/TrekFM. You can interact with John and I at the Babel Conference, which is our listeners-only discussion group on Facebook. To get there, type Babel into the search field there on Facebook, or if you're on our website at trek.fm, you can click discussion on any of the menu bars, and that'll bring you there as well. And you can write us an email. Go to trek.fm/contact, choose a show, choose the 602 Club, and that'll come straight to me. And, of course, you can leave us a voicemail. Love getting those. speakpipe.com/trekfm. Now, John, when we last left James Bond,
yes.
he had just had an amazing adventure. And, you know, we talked through that one with Thunderball, and there were some things that we liked and some things that we didn't. And this one was really interesting because there's a lot of things that happened before the film, before they even got to filming You Only Live Twice. In fact, that was not even their first goal. Their
right.
goal was actually to
yeah.
film on Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Yeah, yeah. And I kind of don't blame them for, well, wanting to shoot OHMSS. And I don't blame them for switching over to You Only Live Twice, to be quite honest. You know, it's as interesting to follow the behind the scenes on the James Bond movies as it is to follow the movies themselves. To pull off the movies on the epic scale that they do, you're mobilizing an army to make a movie. And as you talked about last time on the show, the rights that were involved with making Thunderball and that turning out the way that it did, that was a whole other piece of drama going on in the background.
Yes. You know?
But I think that in some ways they made the right movie at the right time. It's very hard now in retrospect, and usually hindsight is 20/20. It's very hard now in retrospect to think about this movie coming out in 1968. And it's very hard for me to think about Our Majesty's Secret Service coming out after the trajectory of Dr. No from Russia with Love, Goldfinger, and Thunderball. We've talked before about how those first few movies, and in particular from Russia with Love and Goldfinger and Thunderball, they really feel like they're building on each other. They're successive links in the chain, and they're finding their way with each story. And they're figuring out ways, for better or for worse, to kind of outdo themselves with each movie. You Only Live Twice is firmly in that mold of what worked before, what can we do to wow the audience? We're very self-aware of the pop culture surrounding what we're doing here. How do we make it bigger and better? Our Majesty's Secret Service isn't that movie. It has a very different feel to it, at least the way that it was produced. And honestly, I don't know if I could picture Sean Connery in OHMSS. And I don't know if I could picture another actor in You Only Live Twice, whether it would be George Lazenby or if had this gotten pushed off again, a guy like Roger Moore.
You know, that's a really interesting question, because it's something that I've been thinking about a lot in realizing and, you know, researching, watching the extras, seeing that their thought was that they wanted on Her Majesty's Secret Service. And the real reason is because they would have been required to find some high and snowy locations, and that just wasn't going to happen at the time of year. They weren't going to get what they needed when they were trying to make this. And so it was easy for them to say, well, you know, we'll just do You Only Live Twice. And I think you're right, because when I think of the movie that we do get in OHMSS, there is a vitality to it that's not here in Sean. This one, I think, fits Sean where he is, the age that he is, where he is in the character. I think this one almost just fits him like a glove. It's everything that he's already done, whereas I think On Her Majesty's Secret Service is really going to stretch the character of James Bond. And it almost just doesn't feel like that's what Connery would want to do, because the reason he's leaving is because he's tired.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned it last time when we were talking about Thunderball. You really responded to him looking older and it feeling like it's kind of a slog to get through that movie. And now looking back at those first four in retrospect, I kind of see the same thing. It's not the same Sean Connery from 1962, even though we're talking about a relatively short period of time to go from, well, you know, give him 1961 when he gets cast to 1966 shooting You Only Live Twice, and then it came out in 67 in the US anyway. That's not a huge chunk of time, but you can tell that it has aged Connery a bit.
Yes, yes.
You know? And I think with the storyline of OHMSS, it would be a little bit harder to believe that the guy who has gone from fantastical film to fantastical film with the Connery movies would then be back in a story that in ways is more intimate and is a little more personal for Bond.
In some ways, too, you know, I was thinking about this film, and it was funny. This will give you behind the scenes of just kind of how my mind works. A lot of times when I'm thinking about the show and things we're going to talk about, I will kind of lay there in bed at night and play through things in my head. And I was actually thinking about this last night. The idea that On Her Majesty's Secret Service, the plot seems, when you think about it, it seems a little bit fantastical. But actually, it's really not. It's pretty small, and it's very realistic, this kind of idea of germ warfare, that kind of thing, people you wouldn't expect delivering all of it, all that kind of stuff. And it fits very much within the psychedelic 60s, too, with what they're doing and all that. And we'll talk about that next time. But... Yep. This one is so much rooted in everything, like you were saying, that we've already gotten with Bond. And like you said, that kind of everything's just getting bigger and more verbose, even Connery. right. So because I also noticed in this film, Sean's not in shape anymore.
Yeah.
He's just not. He reminds me of... the times that you can tell that Shatner hasn't been working out as much in the original series. That's kind of what we're starting to get. And it's nothing against Sean. That's mm-hmm. just what happens as we all get older. I know I've got about 15, 20 pounds more on me than I did when I was like 10 years younger.
Yeah.
Just because of the, you know, body's changed, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think that... The writers and creators here, I think Broccoli and Saltzman really make the right choice to go with You Only Live Twice, because I really do think that it fits the character that they're going to have, that they already have. And it's a great way. I mean, if this is going to be Sean's last film, this is a big, bold, brassy film for him to go out on.
Yep. Yeah. It fits the bond that they have. Maybe OHSS would have worked with Connery a few years before if they had decided to go that direction, which also would have looked and felt very different had it been made in 1964. Now, all that said, speculating about whether or not OHMSS would have worked with another actor, and I'm sure we'll come back to it when we talk about that movie, you know, I think that Honor Majesty's Secret Service needed a better actor, probably in the central role. Though Lazenby has his strengths, brings me back to the question of whether or not You Only Live Twice would have worked with another actor. And then I think about the similarities of this with The Spy Who Loved Me, because there are many. And we'll probably revisit the plot line of You Only Live Twice when we get to The Spy Who Loved Me.
Well, that, and I'm thinking too, you know, and it's Roald Dahl who wrote this, pretty much just stole the basic plot, he said, from Dr. Mm-hmm. No.
Yeah.
So, and they put the name You Only Live Twice on it, but it's pretty much the same thing, just hyped up. It's basically Dr. No on steroids
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
with a budget of like five times as much. So,
right.
which
much.
I think leads us to a very interesting thing about, you know, what's next, which... Once they figured out it was You Only Live Twice, they have a huge bombshell that Sean drops on them saying, this is going to be my last movie. I'm done. And yeah. I wanted to ask you right up front, because I think it will color everything else. Do you feel like Connery performs more as he does in the first three? Or does this feel like an extension of the tiredness that we kind of both picked up on in Thunderball? Do you feel like this was he gave a performance that made you think, okay, Connery went out on top? You know, we're discounting the fact, obviously, we know he comes back for one more film after this, and we'll talk about that when we get there.
Right.
Next year, thank God, we have a lot of time to prepare for that. But does this one feel like he gave you the performance that, as a fan, especially at the time, you would have been happy with?
Well, I think it's all right, but I think the problem is maybe a little bit of fatigue has set in, not necessarily for Connery, but for the audience. We know what we're getting. And again, the producers have got to be very self-aware of making movies that top the other movies. They know that they're not just in charge of a movie, they're in charge of a franchise. They're in charge of a pop culture phenomenon. So I sort of get the impression that Connery is having fun with this movie. This is a fast-paced movie. There are exotic locations, even though there's one real location, which we'll talk about. But I get the feeling that there is a bit of levity and tongue-in-cheek with this that's not necessarily there with Thunderball. But I think, as you and I talked about, the problem with Thunderball is that Thunderball is kind of a mess in some ways. It's not specific to Connery. It's not specific to anybody in the movie. It's sort of just a big, bloated movie with many, many high points in it. There are many great things about Thunderball, but it's sort of long. And yes, you kind of get lost in all the underwater photography. So there are things working against it anyway, stylistically. This, Because You Only Live Twice, feels different. And with every movie, they're stepping toward that bigger, better, bolder, a little more modern. You know, you've got all this kind of great gadgetry in downtown Tokyo, which even 45, 50 years ago still looks futuristic. So there's a lot working in their favor with this movie.
It's funny because I watched the film specifically with this in mind to kind of try and answer this question. And I think you're right. I feel like Connery is having fun. And I feel like he's giving a decent performance. I don't think it's his best, but I do feel like that the film itself and it going faster and all of that stuff, I think that it is working. And I really like it. I feel like that it fits. And I feel like that for the most part, you know, for the audience, if this was Connery's last film and he never came back, I feel like he did the part justice. I think that it's just one of those things where I can't imagine being the film producers in this place to realize that this is your star's last movie. And I think, too, if he didn't feel like that beforehand, I think that he probably would have felt like that during this filming, because they had many a times, it was over 100 degrees when they were filming in Japan. And from the moment that he got there and from the moment the production started there, they were hounded by the press and the fans. It was brutal for them. And I think, you know, there's a great interview on the extras with Sean's ex-wife talking about how he couldn't go anywhere without people knowing him and basically just kind of being all over him. And so I really do. I think that it makes sense when we talk about the fatigue factor, when we talk about his life in general, what had become. And, you know, I guess if you're Sean, at this point, you've probably made a lot of money and you're ready to move on to something else. And it makes sense to say, you know what, this James Bond thing's been fun, but it's time for me to move on. And honestly, I think just by the look of Sean, I think he made a wise choice at this moment in his life, again, discounting that he'll come back, to not basically end up doing what Roger Moore did, which was to way overstay your welcome.
Yeah, well, and you know what? This is at a time when, with very rare exceptions, you weren't in the business of franchise building.
Right.
It's not like today where we expect our actors to stay in the same role for 20, 30 years. You know, very few. I mentioned once before on one of our Bond shows, you know, Charlie Chaplin, as an actor doing the role of the little tramp, was able to do that role for more than 20 years, but plugging that character into different situations. He was also in creative control. So a little bit different thing there, even when you fast forward a bit and you get to like the Thin Man series. Okay, right. There's only a handful of Thin Man movies. We didn't expect them to pick it up again 20 years later and come back and do that character, or do those characters, Nick and Nora. So we're on very kind of new ground here with the idea that this production is just getting bigger and bigger and will go on in perpetuity. But you've got an actor here who is faced with this totally new problem of, well, I'm the biggest star in movies there is right now. I've made four of them back to back. Do I really want to continue after a fifth? I don't blame them.
No, I don't at all. And it brings to mind this day, I'm thinking that, Hugh Jackman, he's mm-hmm. been playing Wolverine. This will be his 16th year in the role, and it'll be his last film coming out next year called Logan.
Yeah.
Fantastic for him to have had that longevity, and he has appreciated every moment. I think that's one of the things I've always appreciated about him as an actor, understanding the blessing that he's been given, that people want to keep coming back and seeing you. And I think, a part of me feels like Sean understood that, but mm-hmm. I think he also understood just where he was in life. And yeah. So I'm not upset that he wouldn't be back if I'm in that time period. And honestly, I wish he had never come back, because I think he just doesn't do himself a favor in coming back. But that's a whole another conversation yep. for yep. a couple of podcasts down the road. What's interesting is that being right smack dab in the middle of the 60s, we're also in the middle of the space race. And so, Dr. No was one where we're just at the very beginning of that. We're right in the middle of it. And so I think that it's very interesting for this movie to come out when it does. And the idea of, supremacy in space is very close to what's happening in that world at that time and how important it is. And so Bond, again, is doing that thing where it just kind of, it's getting that pinpoint moment and having that perfect story to really capture the imagination of, the entire world.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of funny that you look back at it now, and the space race was a political thing, that it was about supremacy, and you put that kind of in finger quotes, supremacy in space, and it was really about bragging rights. We didn't know how weaponry in space would or could work. Now in the 21st century,
we hadn't had Moonraker yet, so we just didn't know.
Right, we didn't know, yeah. But now in the 21st century, and for the better part of the end of the 20th century, we realized that the space race is really about functional satellites, things like GPS and communications. It's about commercial services that can be operated from space. It's really about that. It's not so much anymore that we're worried about who will build a base on the moon or who will put weapons in space. I mean, that is a real thing. There can and will be weapons in space. But I think our perception of that in the 60s was something very different from what it is now. And it was literally a race. Who, the Soviets had already gotten the first satellite in space. They'd already got the first person in space. It was a big deal when we got the first American in space. And by damn, we were going to get the first man on the moon, But it just meant something very different. And there was this very real fear that if we didn't do it and we didn't control it, somebody was going to do it before us, and that would just mean the end of the world.
And it's so interesting to me that in a lot of ways, Spectre and the whole idea of Spectre in this film is so ahead of its time, because that's exactly what we're dealing with more in our time period. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the things that made the movie Spectre so interesting, is because it felt more realistic to have this behind the scenes organization controlling all this stuff, because it actually is a reality in our world today. But the idea that they would be the ones who would have supremacy in space, and that's what Blofeld is working towards, that is a very scary thing in that time period. It's not the Russians and it's not the Americans. It's somebody completely different, and they've got nothing but evil on their minds,
Right. And you could get away with it in the 60s because you only had a handful of satellites to deal with.
That's very true. Like
Apollo manned missions. You can't do that now. It's just too much stuff, But yeah,
it starts to look like Wall-E.
right. But to your point, the idea that somebody could disrupt governments that are doing this. I mean, we live in a day and age where now our biggest security concern is computers. who can get into what computers. And it could be a government, but it could be a lone agency that we're not even aware of, you know? So there is something worrisome about that.
Well, and as we're recording this in 2016, this Monday, the internet was interrupted big time with many different services, from Facebook to Twitter to Netflix to all sorts of other things, because of a security breach from a small company that nobody had ever heard of until this week. Yeah. It has a really important job when it comes to what we do in the internet. And yeah, you're right. That is completely scary. So when you think about what this film is talking about, it's very applicable. And you can kind of, if you put it in those kind of terms, you can understand what the fear then is in this movie. And I still think that that actually really works, because that is the thing that we're scared of, is that thing that we can't control being in control of something they shouldn't be in control of.
Yeah.
You know, as bad as our government is, or Russia is, or I'm okay, more okay with them being in control of something than I am a rogue agency, which I have no idea, I have no understanding of, you know. And so I think this makes for a very, again, it's very timely. And I think the writers and the producers of James Bond really understood this, especially in these early films, that helped make them feel as fantastical as this movie's going to get, and it's going to blow the lid off of fantastical for spy genre.
Right.
It has a foundation of reality that's very true. And I think that's what makes it still kind of work, even today, in that sense, when we're talking just about the plot, which... Coming to plot, we have a very interesting, and one might say the fantastic Mr. Writer, who comes in, because they lose their screenwriter, and so they pull in a good friend of Ian Fleming, Roald Dahl, and he's never done a script before. And he comes in and writes this plot. And this is, this is his quote. He says, Ian Fleming's worst book with no plot in it, which would ever make a movie. He compared it to a travelogue, stating that he had to create a new plot. And he could only retain 4 or 5 of the original story ideas. And so basically, in creating the plot, he didn't know what the hell Bond was going to do. But he decided to go with basically the basic plot of Dr. No and the girl formula, which he called it, which I think that's funny. Dr. No plot, girls, girl done.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, Ian Fleming wrote some great stories, and he wrote some other stories. And it's funny that, you know, he...
And if you've read Live and Let Die, you know exactly what we're talking about.
Right. Well, I think that, you know, Fleming wasn't afraid of doing a travelogue. There's short stories like James Bond in New York, which honestly to me is memorable because it's where we get the recipe for scrambled eggs James Bond, you know? So Fleming just sort of, paper is cheap. Ink is cheap. I will just write up my own musings about visiting a town and eating eggs. So great. He could do that. Doesn't always make for a great movie script. So
that was a really short James Bond film. That was the animated short film.
Right.
That they did. Yeah.
Exactly. Yes. 80 seconds long and then you're done. No, but I mean, you know, I've never felt that a movie necessarily owed anything to a book, that a movie needs to stand on its own. It needs to be its own thing. So if the best script writer for this is going to be Roald Dahl, who we know from, you know, the Willy Wonka stories, cool, great, get him to do it. And then what he cooks up definitely feels like Bond. You know, he figured out the formula, if that is indeed what he was working from.
Well, and I think it's interesting, and... to comment back on Her Majesty's Secret Service, which is a movie that is pretty much the book. Mm-hmm. And that is because it is probably the pinnacle of Bond books. it's a great story. It's a wonderful story, and they didn't really have to change all that. In fact, I don't really think they changed all that much at all, right. If I remember correctly, because I've read that one and really enjoyed it. And it was surprised that it was pretty much beat by beat the movie, and that they hadn't had to deviate. Whereas, yeah, this one, like many of the James Bond movies, if you read the book and then you read the movie, they're very different properties. Mm-hmm. They kind of just will take the name and then, you know, slap that name on a story that they have created because you run into this problem. And I, you know, for not being a screenwriter, I feel like that he did create a movie that did all it needed to do, which it felt Bondish.
Yeah.
And it fit within the formula. And I think that this movie, in some ways, is smart to go outlandish because it makes it feel different than Dr. No, even though when you think about it, it pretty much is the exact same villain plot.
Right. Right. Yeah. But, you know, but again, they knew what worked. So, and what most audiences want out of their sequels is they want the same but different. So if we're already anticipating who Bond is and what he does and what his relationships are like and what the bad guy is like that he needs to battle, then we're getting the same but different. So they probably gambled maybe a little too closely to that on this side, but they dressed it up with a different locale, a different style, and it works in some weird way because of that.
I think that you're right, because it really does work. And what made it really interesting was everything that happened with the filming of this movie, because there was a lot of stuff that it had a troubled watching the extras, they say that this movie was, to that time period, was one of the most troubled productions they had. They had so many things happening. And one of them was when they went on their first scouting mission to Japan, they're scheduled to leave on a certain flight. And they cancel that because they're going to be able to see a ninja demonstration, which is very strange because I don't know how you watch a ninja demonstration since they vanish. but the flight that they were supposed to be on crashed 40 minutes into the flight and killed everybody on board.
Wow.
And so Saltzman, Broccoli, the director, producer, I mean, all of them would have been gone. Yeah. I mean, talk about crazy providence to not be on that flight. I mean, James Bond could have been over before it really became the phenomenon because of that.
It would have changed the course of history for at least for this whole franchise, and in a, you know, not too dramatic way, or a not undramatic way. So, yeah, it's shocking to think of that.
Well, I think it's interesting too, because, you know, you have the great scenes with Little Nelly, and I think that as fun as they are, they also feel a little bit like the underwater, where we're so excited about what we can do. The scene is probably a little long, but
make sure you see it and make sure you enjoy it. Yeah.
It is a fantastic sequence, and you know, you have somebody who's in a real gyrocopter there being flown by RAF Wing Commander Ken Allis, and they're filming those scenes. And during one of those scenes, the great aerial photographer John Jordan almost loses his leg because he's hit by a rotor and ends up having to have the leg taken off because it just it won't heal right, and he's in a lot of pain, and he actually recovers after that very well. But I mean, just a huge blow, and in fact they don't even film the rest of those scenes till much later on, when they're really forced to. And in fact, they don't film them in the same place. They actually just choose a location in Spain that kind of fits the look and the feel, but half of that scene is not shot in location over in Japan, because after what happened, they were not going to let them film there anymore. So they had to film the rest in Spain.
Yeah, and you know the stuff that is the practical effects really works well. Of course, you get some unfortunate composite shots where you have close-ups on Connery, but we just have to chalk that up to the technology of the day. So what? The things that are really happening are really exciting. It's cool to see all those gags work. It's cool to see little Nelly actually fly.
And when they're doing the scene where they're building it, and he's like, Tanaka's like, James, let me you have one of my helicopters. See, this is not a good idea. And I mean, the audience at that time period is probably thinking the same thing. James Bond's going to go up in this. This is crazy. Not a good idea.
And you know what? And it's a weird little sequence where they're building little.
Yes.
That's not a thing you see very often. You know, montages in film are usually done with just sort of slow dissolves from one shot to another. You see people moving in and out of frame, but to see this thing sort of go together in a weird, like, freeze frame way, it's a really odd thing. I can't think of any other movies off the top of my head that do that. There's probably some, but it feels like it's pulled from a different movie to go into this. You know, the Bond movies aren't things that are shot with a really kind of out there style. Now you get to the later movies, you get to you get to Skyfall, and that's a movie where there's a lot of artistry in every shot, but it's also a kind of artistry that really establishes mood, that plays a lot with color. But this is just sort of like a weird thing, almost like a budget saving thing. You know, don't worry about it. We don't actually have to show them building it. We'll just throw the pieces together. We get a still at each step of the way, and then the audience will buy it. It'll go.
And what it's so interesting is how the fact that it kind of works, because it lets you know as the audience that this is something that is real. Mm-hmm. It has a reality to it. So you're seeing, you know, those stills basically of them building it and putting all the different pieces together. It's almost as like you're turning the page with Legos, you know, right. And watching the pieces come together. And that's what's happening. And I think that's really fascinating. And it gives you that sense that, okay, this is something that actually exists. It's not just a screen gag, and we're going to put a man in that and they're going to fly it, and it's going to be James Bond. It's going to be cool. And mm-hmm. I think that's a really neat thing. Like you said, the practical elements of James Bond are one of the things that really do make James Bond stand out from a lot of other film franchises, because that was their hallmark. We do this for real. You know, we do this S for real. We don't, you know, CGI it until, you know, we have him on a die another day. Anyway, so I thought this was fascinating because, you know, James Bond wasn't known for its, how shall we put this, tact, I guess, when getting people to play certain nationalities. Obviously, Dr. No, not really.
Sure.
Not really good there. But this film, because they're filming so heavily in Japan, Japan is very keen to have them. The Japanese are very keen to have them have actresses that are actually Japanese.
Yeah.
And this is the hardest thing for them to do, because there are very few actresses in Japan at the time that would actually be of the caliber that they would need. And two, none of them speak English. So yeah. I thought this was fascinating. They choose the two best that they can find, and they actually send them to England to teach them English. And one of them, it's not really working all that well. She's not picking it up. They go to basically fire her, and she says she's going to commit suicide.
Oh,
and
no.
So Cubby Broccoli says, you know what? She's not so bad after all. So she stays in the film, and they switch her role. So she is not playing Aki anymore. Mm-hmm. And she has the smaller role and allows her to stay in the film. But I just thought, I like that they stayed committed to having those actresses be Japanese and not doing that thing, which, you know, sometimes even happens today, where we choose an actress or an actor that is Asian, but not the right nationality. And there's a big difference.
Right. Yeah, no, it works in this. I mean, I have to say that, and we'll talk about them more specifically later, but I really like Aki, and I like the relationship with Bond. I like how it changes over time, through the movie. For a movie that I think has maybe a challenging perspective on Japan, I think this is where this is all leading. You know, the end of this podcast will be sort of our thesis on how this movie approaches Japan. And there are many downsides to the way it does that, but there are many good choices it makes with that. And I think one of the good choices they made was picking the right actresses for this movie and making sure that there's a level of authenticity there.
No, I agree. And I think it does make it feel more realistic, like that they are in Japan. And I like that the women, they have not the perfect English. And because that makes sense, especially Japan at that time period. You know, it's just not the same as it is now, where I know a lot of Japanese people speak English, as a second language, because it's the business language. And so, yeah, I think it really works. But just the fact of having to go through that, trying to get them to actually learn English, it speaks well for them. And that's just another thing while filming, because of the heat and because of the long days, and because of they were just having a hard time with the crowds. The producers, Saltzman and Broccoli, are said to have treated the crew and the cast extremely well, and to given them everything that they needed and more. The director even said, I feel as though, Lewis Gilbert said, if I wanted 100 people from Tokyo down here today, they would be here. So I think it's really one of those things where good producers understand how to treat their cast and crew to give them the best product. And I think that kind of shows in the film, because you don't feel any of the stuff that happened in this movie. Yeah. In fact, you don't feel it in any of the James Bond movies. When we were talking about From Russia with Love, you don't feel the problems that they had on that movie whatsoever. So I think it's a real testament to the James Bond movies and the creators of the James Bond series that they do a good job of treating everybody behind the scenes and in front of the camera very well, so that I think that comes across even if it's a tumultuous shoot.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Which leads us to a fantastic discussion, I think, on Blofeld and the women. And we almost had a completely different Blofeld.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure, as Lewis Gilbert, the director, said, that he resembled a poor, benevolent Santa Claus.
Yeah, so we may have had a Blofeld that looks like Santa Claus. And honestly, I don't know how that would look if he had a giant scar down his eye and down his cheek. It might frighten children for years to come if they think about Santa Claus like that. I think, once again, they made the right casting choice by putting Donald Pleasance in there. Yeah, it has, the voice, the look, they all go together.
I think they did too. Now, I won't say that I like him as Blofeld the best, because I watch him as Blofeld here, he doesn't feel like Blofeld from the other films, where all you're seeing is the cat, the person with that kind of almost monotone voice, the presence that voice and just the small look that you get. Donald Pleasance doesn't bring that to me. He kind of comes off as almost like a crazed, maniacal, strange, I don't know, just he feels like a very strange man, whereas the person that I get in, just the voice, just the hands and the cat, there's something about that that creeps you out. But when I see Donald Pleasance and get his performance, there's nothing about it that creeps me out or makes me feel like it's really the same character.
The problem with this Blofeld is that he is so iconic. He's so recognizable. He has such a weird, creepy look that became the Blofeld that every other Bond parody villain, you know, Dr. Evil. He is Dr. Evil, you know.
I mean, he's even got, you know, the freaking piranhas. They just don't have freaking laser beams on them.
Yeah. But that's the problem, is that he's so recognizable. He's so iconic, and he's weird. He's definitely weird that you can't help but associate that performance with everything that's come after it. So if you go through the other actors, I mean, Max von Sydow, if you go to Christoph Waltz, he has cornered the market on playing creepily understated, dangerous characters. So of course he's Blofeld, you know. Even Telly Savalas, you know, when we get to OHMSS, there's something that's grounded about Telly Savalas, whereas this character is so over the top, but still, I mean, to me, just creepy and weird. The problem is the standard that set. It's not that I think Donald Pleasance did a bad job at that. I think that it's just so outstanding because of its creepy weirdness that you can't help but just say, oh, that is the definitive Bond villain. That is sort of the cartoonish and broad strokes Bond villain. That hurts this movie in retrospect.
No, I think you're exactly right. And I think it's one of the things that the Savalas Blofeld has above this one, because that one feels dangerous and in control. This one feels like a weird loose cannon, and not that that's bad for a Bond villain, because I think that makes for a good Bond villain in some places, but you know, he's supposed to be the leader of a criminal organization beyond all others. He just doesn't feel like the man to be that with that performance to
me. Get on now.
So, you know, and you're right. I think because we live in the time where we have seen 1,000 Bond parodies, when you do go back to watch this movie, you can't help but have it almost ruined that he feels cartoonish by comparison. Yeah. And especially to even the other villains to which we've seen in James Bond, who none of them are cartoony. You know, Goldfinger's really just a high-class thief. And, Largo felt like a mob boss, basically, with an awesome boat. All of these people felt quite more realistic. I mean, and then I guess the most cartoony was probably Dr. No. And yet, there's such an understatedness the way in which he's played that I think it makes it feel more believable. So, yeah, it's really interesting. I'm just not my favorite Blofeld. Anyway.
Yeah, fair enough.
We have some fantastic, I do think we have some fantastic Bond women in the movie. Some wonderful, as we talked about, the Japanese actresses that they choose. And I like both of them. Mm-hmm. I think Aki and Kissy, both of them, are really in control characters. Aki, you know, being the fact that she is a part of the Japanese Secret Service, really fantastic, very in control character. The way that she kind of treats Bond at the beginning, almost kind of throwing him off, whatever, you know, I thought was great, you know, that she doesn't have any kind of respect for him. You know, she's a Secret Service agent too, and this is part of her job, you know, and I really liked that.
Yeah. There's an actual arc to her character, and then her death has impact. And that's something that when Bond gets it wrong, they just sort of have a death of a character, a female character, just because it's sort of supposed to happen to push the plot. But in this case, she is, you know, she's in danger because of the job she's in, and she's good at her job, and she's not just sort of immediately submissive to Bond. you know, she is her own person. She is her own character. I really like her. And I like I said earlier, that there are layers to her relationship with Bond, that it's actually something that grows over time, as opposed to just they meet, she throws herself at him, and then she's dead, you know, by the time you get to know her. She's not that at all. So I think of the two, you know, between Aki and Kissy Suzuki, I do like Aki, and I like her car quite a lot.
That is a cool car. I'm right there with you. I really like that car. I also like, you know, the fact that Kissy Suzuki is Tanaka's own protege, as an agent. So that makes her somebody that he can trust, and somebody who obviously, again, just like Aki, very good at her job. So what I like is that these women are very competent in what they do, and they are seen as equals to these men. Now, whether or not sometimes the dialogue treats them as equals is a completely different story. But where they are on the level, I mean, both of these women are on the level of, say, a James Bond. That's their job. So I really like what they're doing in that side. The dialogue sometimes for them undercuts that, and that's a little bit unfortunate.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then Karen Dorr as number 11. Oh, yeah. You know, she's great. She's gorgeous and she's dangerous. And you know, that's what we want out of our Spectre villainess. And just, you know, the flaming red hair. She's absolutely kind of that prototypical Bond villain. So I love seeing her in there.
Well, and what I love about her is that she plays the female character that pretends to fall for Bond's advances and wants to turn, and then she uses that to try and kill him.
Just
in a plane
flat
crash.
Out gonna kill him.
And it's fantastic. I mean, because you feel like, oh, they're just going back to kind of a pussy galore thing. And then, you know, she jumps out of the plane and leaves him for dead. And that's, in some ways, they have learned.
Yeah. Now, what they didn't learn is that, you know, Blofeld is far better at killing his own people than the people who are against him. He dispatches Osato, but he dispatches number 11 pretty quickly, pretty easily. She meets a very unfortunate end. And, you know, I get it in the script that they're trying to fake us out with Blofeld pulling the gun on Osato and then just sort of saving Bond a little bit until he can get into his single-person monorail car. That's a little strange, but you know, I guess if you're a bad guy and you have to get killed by another bad guy, then getting eaten by piranha is okay. So she had an iconic death.
Yes, she did. Yeah. No laser beams were used, and no piranhas were harmed in the making of this film.
Right.
Just want everybody to know that. That's very important. But no, I do. I enjoy the Bond women in this film for the most part, and I think it's well done. I wish that, and this is where, you know, talking about Japan itself, I think they do such a magnificent job in a few things in this, but then on the other side, they do some things that just, I think, I don't know how true to life it is, so I can't comment, but the things they do well, one, they make Japan look amazing. And James Bond movies are known for that. They are so well known for taking a place and making it feel exotic, whether it is or not.
Yeah.
Japan just happens to look beautiful, the film. And then, two, it leads to, because Japan doesn't have the castles that Fleming writes about, they come up with this audacious plan to have Blofeld's lair be in a hollowed-out volcano, because Japan has this volcano region. And it leads to one of Ken Adams, I mean, one of the most iconic, incredibly made, real sets you've ever seen. that has a working monorail. It has a roof that retracts. It has helicopters that can fly in and out of it. This set cost as much as Dr. No itself.
It is a shockingly beautiful set. It is so cool. And that was one of the great things about rewatching this for this podcast, is so seeing it in HD and then kind of freeze framing through, whether it's a shot in the control room, the wood veneer on the control panels. I took a special delight in hearing the PA announcers throughout the volcano lair announcing everything that was happening.
Right.
It's just something so strange and wonderful about it that I love. The scale of it is incredible. The effects that are done on top of that set are incredible. It is it's so immersive, and you do sit there and wonder, like, well, there's no way that a secret organization could build something this magnificent, stick it into a volcano. Well, you don't have to believe that. What you need to believe is that a movie company actually built that set.
Yep.
You know? Sure, they weren't actually capturing, you know, spacecraft, but everything else worked. It was magnificent. And that holds up today just beautifully. You know, the other stuff about Japan that you're saying, so there's two sides to this. You know, Japan in popular culture is sort of a shorthand to represent deep, rich, and beautiful culture. And we see that with, like, the use of Himeji Castle and some of the grounds that we see. And then this incredibly advanced future. And we see that with the shots of Tokyo, just neon lights everywhere. And it looked like that then, and it looks like that now. Tiger Tanaka, we didn't get to talk too much about Tiger, but I think he is a super cool character. And when you go into his office, when Bond slips into his underground office, that is the coolest office any
secret agent
has anywhere.
Nothing like the spy slide.
It's what?
Nothing like the spy slide.
Of course. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You're going to get anywhere. Travel by spy slide if you can. So Japan is a great stand-in for that. There's also this weird thing about the time this movie was made. Okay. Made in 1966. And you have to think that, you know, 20 years before was when World War II was ending. But you had also a lot of Allied troops who were still there for years after, during the kind of reconstruction of that Japan needed after being devastated during the war. So Japan is still this sort of exotic, and in some ways, you know, mysterious, also kind of a hands-off place to a lot of people. They were our enemies, you know, shortly more than 20 years before this movie came out. So there's a bit of baggage for an audience to unpack of seeing this place and depicted the way it's depicted. The other thing that I think is, you know, what we're sort of dancing around with this, and when it deals with the women in the movie, you know, there's this scene where Bond goes to Tiger's house. And honestly, the dialogue might as well be Tiger Tanaka saying, "The women here are objects for your use." You know, it's really disturbing. It's really uncomfortable to see that. And you try to be a good critic and you put it into a certain kind of cultural context, which is, it's the 1960s. And pop culture in the 1960s and the general culture in the 1960s treated women differently than they are treated or should be treated now. I think we all understand that. But there's also this other thing about, it's Ian Fleming, this war hero, writing from the comfort of his home in Goldeneye or possibly London, but writing about a kind of Japan that is this exotic place where the rules about men and women are very different from what we accept in Western society. And it's sort of playing into this desire of the exotic, that if it's if it's something that the men can't get themselves by going to Japan, well, he's sort of playing right into that audience of thinks like, hey, you know, the tiki bar in my neighborhood is a representation of exotic culture. You know, this far off place that I can't actually go to in real life, but I can pretend that I'm partaking in this exotic, weird culture, this exotic, weird place that I can't actually put my fingers on, but I know it's out there somewhere. So it's playing into this whole fantasy world, this whole fantasy that, you know, white men are creating to tell themselves about what the rest of the world is like. And like I said, I think that in the 21st century here, we've got to be careful about putting this into the right context. It's easy to condemn the way women are treated in this movie, even though you make a good case for the fact that they are capable, that they do things that are equal to Bond. You know, Aki is an agent. She is trained to be a badass in the field. Unfortunately, the context around that is this thing that today we can and should see as a little unsavory. It's not the way we want the world to operate today. So if we look at that and we accept it and we go, okay, this is a book written at a different time, a movie that was produced at a different time. These were kind of the cultural attitudes around it. It's almost as if, you know, the 20th century is catching up to the Western world, but there's going to be this last gasp of the Western world to say, oh, well, look at the way they still treat women in Japan. Wouldn't it be great to go there for a little while? And that's kind of what Tiger is saying to Bond. That's where it feels a little creepy to me.
I agree because, you know, this film does have that uncomfortable feeling in a few places because of that. And I think that's okay for us to feel. And I think the way that you put it of, you know, understanding historically and contextually, because context is king, context is everything. You know, without that context, you can't understand why and how we've moved to where we have moved because of the reasons that we would find this to be unsavory, or let's just call it wrong behavior towards women. It's just not right to treat women like this.
Yeah, yeah. And it doesn't mean you can't enjoy the movie. It doesn't mean that there aren't great things about this movie. It's just that that's sort of the elephant in the room. You watch this movie, and I think we made a good case previously why a character like Pussy Galore is a strong character. And why, yes, you could look at her and say, well, you know, she's the one who's just sort of turned by Bond, so she doesn't have her own agency. Well, I think there's another argument to be made that that character is a strong character. And there are other Bond women who are strong characters or I think are given short shrift. And it's not to say that Kissy and Aki aren't strong characters, but they're presented in a context that is sort of, you know, they're there for the men because that's what Tiger says. And that's the thing that's uncomfortable to watch in this. So we just have to like accept it and go, okay, that was the culture. That was the way this was written. That's what came out in 1967. That's not going to fly in 2017.
Well, and one of the things about it, I think that I'm seeing, and I saw watching the film again, I hadn't seen this one in a while. I was actually surprised, you know, watching them in progression. There is so much sexual innuendo in this movie compared to the other Bond movies. I think we think of that as being there all the time, but really it's not. There are some very tasteful and funny innuendos throughout the earlier Bond films, but this one is saturated with them. Whether it's about little Nelly or any of the other women in the film, it's just so there.
Well, I think it's a couple of things going on. You know, I think it's A, that 1966 is different from 1961.
Very true.
I think it's also that, again, they're given this freedom. Well, the Bond movies know that they can push that envelope and they will continue to do so. But I think it's also part of the cultural context. It's like, well, we're going to set this someplace so foreign to everybody else who's watching this movie that we can kind of get away with tweaking that and making it a little more sexualized and throw in the innuendo that we want. You know, again, because we're painting this picture of saying that Asia, just in general, and in this case, Japan in particular, but Asia in general, it's this exotic place where you can just sort of get away with stuff.
Well, and I think you make a great point as well. Just when you think about the time period which this movie is made, the revolution of sex is happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I think what we are also experiencing is that change in the culture at large.
Yeah.
That this kind of more loose behavior and more loose talk is becoming a little bit more acceptable than it used to be. Obviously, in the very early 60s, you know, still not as much a thing. And unless it's what we, and I put it in air quotes, high society in certain areas like Midtown New York kind of thing. The Mad Men class, basically. Mm-hmm. That's the only kind of place you really kind of see this. Otherwise, middle America, not at all.
Yeah.
But by this point, the world is changing. And so Bond is changing with it in that way. And it's reaping, that sounds weird, but it is reaping the benefits of the fact that the world is becoming more sexually loose. Mm-hmm. And the character is reflecting that, and the dialogue is reflecting that. It was just something that I noticed because watching them in order this way, it stood out to me. I was a little bit shocked.
Yeah, right.
That it was so prevalent, whereas before it had been a funny quip and then you moved on, but this had many of those, and it was like it wasn't as enjoyable actually. I didn't find it as funny or cute or any of those things. It was just kind of like that was juvenile.
Yeah, right.
You know,
right, yeah.
Like so especially when he was talking about Little Nelly like that, it just,
yeah,
that was the other thing that made me uncomfortable. It wasn't just the way they were treating the women, but it was the way that they were implying that women should be treated by talking about their equipment like that, like,
yeah,
and the name, it just makes it feel like
well, it's a diminutive. I mean,
yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And that's so there's all of that going on here. But then the other thing that I think really has to be dealt with in this movie is that, okay, let's take the phrase that I think has become so unfortunately turned into like a lightning rod now, and that's cultural appropriation. You know, I think that when that phrase is used incorrectly, I think people are complaining about incorporating the best of what has come before into other works of art. You know, it's not patently wrong for somebody to be influenced by a piece of art or music or literature from another culture, and then sort of use the filter of their own background and their own culture to create their own art or their own music, their own literature that has pieces of that. I think that's what makes art great and fluid and a reflection of who we are. Now, the bad side of cultural appropriation is where you sort of take the idea, like this movie, you just take Japan and you say, okay, we can figure out Japan. We can sort of put it in a box. We can commodify it. And in fact, we're just going to take our lead character and make him Japanese. Now, say what you will about the makeup job that they do here. To me, this is kind of setting the very low bar for any time a spy movie or, on Mission Log, when we were talking about unification and you've got Data and Picard in Romulan makeup, which is actually more effective because at least the Romulans have a prosthetic that sort of goes a long way. But I sort of look back on what are the poor examples of doing something like that. And this is one of the poorer examples of doing that. There's a dual thing going on in this movie where it is both amazed and celebratory about Japanese culture. It's sort of, you know, a tourist being in awe of what is fascinating about Japanese culture. But there's the flip side to that, that is sort of like the ugly American tourist who thinks they've kind of got it figured out. And it's like, oh, okay, well, all I have to do is study to be a ninja and take a Japanese wife, and I'm done. I've got it figured out. I can pass. That's sort of the underlying thing here that is competing with the beauty of the Japan that is presented in this movie. And again, I think this is part of the time that it was made, who made it, you know, and we can't escape that. I'm going to say, for those who may not believe me, it does not take away from my enjoyment of the movie. But I think it has to be addressed. It has to be dealt with to say that there's a weird, very quote unquote Western attitude that this movie has. So this movie can't help but have because of the time it was made and because of the people who made it.
Well, and I do think that that's interesting because it all flows into it. And there's a scene between the American government, the British government, and the Russian government where they're talking about who's doing what with satellites. And there is this British superiority that comes across. Well, both of you are children.
Absolutely.
And that comes across in every other part of the film as well, especially when we are dealing with what we're doing in Japan. And like you said, Tanaka almost bragging about, it's like saying, don't you wish your girlfriend was hot like me? You know, don't you wish you lived in Japan like me? Right. That's kind of what he's saying, because look how much better we have it. And look how our women treat us, that, you know, none of your English girls would do this, you know. Yeah. You can just become Japanese by putting a wig on and we'll, you know.
Right.
We won't even shave your chest, but it's fine. So, yeah, it's just those things are downsides to the movie. But I think, as you said, taking all of that into account, I don't think it hurts the enjoyment that does come from the movie, because there's a lot of other fun and wonderful parts and scenes. And the product as a whole beyond that can transcend that. Now, I think when we come to the idea of ratings, how does that affect for you, John? And where would you end up rating, do you think, You Only Live Twice?
Yeah, well, you know, that is the complicating factor. You know, you can't help but watch a movie through the lens of somebody in 2016 watching a movie that was made in 1966. That there's a 50-year gap there that accounts for a lot of cultural and social and political change. So you have to be aware of those things. You have to take the things that make you feel uncomfortable in this movie and sort of process them, and, you know, just realize that that same movie wouldn't be made today. Now, the things in this movie that work great. The set pieces, the action. I think this is a better built story than Thunderball in many ways. This is a better paced and a better edited movie than Thunderball, certainly. But the downsides are kind of big downsides. I think we lose momentum when we try to make Bond Japanese. I think this is a big, big mistake. And actually, I thought about it and I thought, you know, maybe one of the ways to fix that was, I love the opening. I love that we kill Bond in the opening. And I love the whole thing with, you know, they have a burial at sea and then he gets rescued. That's fun to watch, right? But I think killing Bond might have been more effective before we decided to make him Japanese. You know, so if we were going to try to do that and just say, well, we have to sneak you onto this island, so then you stage a death, and then you just say, okay, well, we just have to hide you enough to get you there. We're not going to go through the pretense of trying to pretend like we're making you into something that you're not. We just have to make you dead. So you actually do that in the middle of the movie to then justify getting him to the island. So those are things in this movie, as is, that I think kind of slow it down, that are hard to justify in there. So if I had to give it a rating, man, I mean, I really enjoy it. I really do. But there are things that are hard to get past. I think I'm going to give it 3 out of 5 plastic surgeon scalpels.
I like it. All the things that you said are exactly the same for me. In watching this movie, there was a sense that when I was watching this one, I found myself a little bit distracted in the sense of like doing other things. And part of that, I think, comes to that I have seen this plot before in a James Bond movie. But like you said, it is better paced. And I think in the end, it amounts to a better story for the most part than Thunderball. But what's funny is that the things that we talked about where it fails hurt it like Thunderball was hurt because of the story issues and the pacing in that film and all that. So I think that for me, I'm right there with you. This is about 3.5 out of 5 Sakis because it can't completely overcome the issues to which it creates in the way and it tells its story in the same way that Thunderball had that same issue. They just have different issues in the way that plays out story-wise and pacing-wise and everything. They fix the pacing in this much better. They fix the flow of the story much better. But they then added some things into this story to which, you know, whereas in Thunderball, I'm not uncomfortable. I am here,
yeah.
You know, so it's just, it's too bad. But it's still a very fun Bond movie in a lot of ways. It has some great action sequences, and it has, I think, probably Ken Adams' greatest set ever. Legitimately, there are over 100 stuntmen in that place at one time in those final scenes doing stuff. They actually also, we didn't even mention this, but this is the first movie there they really use trampolines for stunts.
Oh, yeah.
Really get the men flying all over the place and stuff. So just some great, great stuff going on here. And cool. Again, pushing forward the filmmaking for James Bond in a lot of ways. So for some of that stuff. So yeah. I think all that, 3.5 out of 5. I love, this has been just such a fun series, and I'm so excited that we have one more for everybody coming in December. John, we'll be talking about On Her Majesty's Secret Service, a good one to talk about in December, since it is a Christmas Bond film, and so,
you know,
no Christmas Jones, but... yes, anyway, no more Christmas jokes. Anyway, gotta slow down. I'm really excited to do that with you, but I want to thank the associate producers here, Ken Tripp, Davis Grayson, Norman Lau. Thank you so much, guys, for supporting us through Patreon and helping make sure that this comes to you, this program and every other program here on Trek FM. If you'd like to be part of the team the way they are, go to patreon.com/trekfm and see how you can help us. There's just no way that we can do this alone, and we definitely need your help. So again, go to patreon.com/trekfm. John, I'm so excited to be continuing this series. It's been such a blast so far. I love sitting down and talking these movies with you. Where can everybody find you online if they'd like to talk some more James Bond with you? Or just, I know that obviously with you doing Mission Log, so let everybody know where they can find you and about the podcast.
Sure, yeah. So my personal Twitter account is @DVDGeeks. So you can find me there. More apt to talk about Bond there. Otherwise, you would find me on missionlogpodcast.com. That'll lead you to our Twitter and Facebook pages from there. So weekly, I'm talking about Star Trek at Mission Log. But yeah, I got to tell you, Matthew, it is so great to be able to kind of break that cycle and talk about Bond and really do it. And what I hope is a kind of a thoughtful and studious way. You know, there's been so much written and discussed about these movies. So I really find it a privilege to be able to share some of my thoughts about these. And it really challenges me to be able to go back and look at them with a fresh view.
I'm so glad too, because, and again, I said this earlier, you know, watching this film in the order that we have been doing, I think is really fantastic for me to sit down and do that. because it's not something that I have done a lot of. In the same way that last year when we were talking through all of the Star Wars films, to watch each of them in sequential order, which I've done before, but to actually talk about them then is kind of get out all the things that kind of come up as you do, and it's just been a blast. So, of course, you can find me on Twitter, MattRushing02. You can also find me here on the network doing The Orb with Chris Jones, where we talk about Deep Space Nine. Also doing Literary Treks with Bruce and Dan about the books and the comics of Star Trek, which is a lot of fun. Interviewing the authors, too, which is a blast, so I hope you will check that out. You can also find me on Aggressive Negotiations with my good friend John Mills as we talk about Star Wars. That's over on thenerdparty.com, or just search Aggressive Negotiations in iTunes. And then a quick reminder, too, if you love Star Wars, the 602 Club does have a special feed. It's called Star Wars, a 602 Club Collection, and you can find that specifically in iTunes, and that just collects every single one of the Star Wars episodes that we put out. It's its own feed, so you can subscribe to that one if those are the episodes that you really love listening to. Well, thank you so much for joining us, and y'all come back now, you hear?